Hey there, pod people. Welcome to Malice Intended. Tonight you have Ben and Steve. Steve is flipping me off right now. You can't see that because it's a podcast, but Steve has been very argumentative today. What's up, Steve?
I did nothing of the sort. I've been nothing but polite.
Right. So, you guys don't know this, but I gave Steve a little bit of homework. So I want to start with the homework, because today we're doing an episode on a serial killer, right? Like, we're a true crime podcast. We do a lot of murder stuff, so serial killers right up the alley for that. And first of all, I want to say why I gave Steve the homework. So the homework that I gave him was to look up a murder where it's twins and only one of the twins has committed murder. The reason I asked you to look that up is the old question of nature versus nurture. I feel like I always lean towards both. When it comes to a serial killer, it almost, to me, has to be like a perfect storm. But the reason being that I'm asking this is because in this case, as opposed to many others, I mean, I can't find anything about like abuse in this guy's life, right? Like, but a lot of cases you have like somebody who's been really abused and then they become a murderer, etc. And so I thought twin studies would be like a really good way to look at whether or not it's leaning heavily genetic. And I found multiple things about serial killers. Like, there's this Spahalski twins, who both actually, like, on their own were serial killers. And then I found many sites of, like, 12 twins who killed together. And, like, twins, like, always doing these horrific things, like, equally or together. So, obviously, there's a good argument for the genetic basis. And you had sent me a thing about a gang member who had been imprisoned for killing someone, but then it turns out his twin brother actually committed the crime. And then he finally confesses after the dude's been in jail forever and then gets him out, etc. But I don't know. What do you feel about the nature versus nurture? Do you think it's pretty much a given that it's a combination?
Well, I think it's a given that it's a combination, but I think it's fascinating what kind of stuff you discover when you look at it at a micro level. Like, you know, where they have done studies on twins who were separated at birth.
Yeah.
And then, you know, looked at what happened, and there's all kinds of occurrences of them, you know, getting similar jobs,
right,
or getting similar people. But then also, like, you know, them having these coincidences in their lives that are just, you know, unexplainable, and so I think the nature argument, you know, is very easy. You can see it at work. You can see environment affecting kids. But then there's some biological stuff that I think is just a mystery.
Right.
What exactly is there that you know, that's genetic, that people are predisposed to? I don't know. That's a fascinating thing to me.
Yeah, it's definitely fascinating. That's why I wanted to kind of look into it. But the problem with it is, as we found, like I said, there's tons of stuff for two twins doing bad things. Not a lot for one and not the other. But I think that what you're looking at there is, number one, twins are not super common. And number two, serial killers are even less common. So you're taking a very, like, a minimal pool, right? Like, there's not a huge pool of twins to study from, and most human beings aren't serial killers, so it's really hard to find examples of one's a serial killer and one's an upstanding human being, if they exist at all.
You know who was obsessed with twins?
Who's that?
Joseph Mengele.
Wasn't
Dr. the Angel of Death.
I was going to say, he was a killer, but that's actually Kevorkian? Or Mengele?
No. Mengele was the
the Nazi doctor, right?
Yeah. And he took a special interest in twins in the camp, and would do just
right
horrific experiments on them.
Yeah, I remember that now.
To see what their links were.
Yeah, he would like do like physical alterations and things, or like torture experiments on one, leave the other one alone. And I remember a specific story where a sister was like tortured, and her other sister, the sister was not, and it was, yeah, that dude was very, very scary.
Yeah. You know who my favorite twins are?
I'm assuming that it's Kid and Play.
No, they're not twins. They're friends who are in a hip-hop group. No, my favorite twins are Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito.
Oh, they were the best twins. And the
best twins ever.
Right? And I always just kind of felt bad for Arnold Schwarzenegger having to live in the shadow of Danny DeVito, but, you know, shit happens.
Well, that late 80s bald on top ponytail in the back that Danny DeVito was rocking in that movie was enviable.
Right? I mean, I think that's why later Van Damme did the ponytail. No, Seagal. Seagal. Yeah.
Seagal. Yeah, he's obviously modeling it after the Danny DeVito one. It's pretty obvious.
Yes, yes. After a period of pondering twins and 80s phenoms, Steve and I decided to get to the topic at hand. Alright, so let's jump in. We are actually today looking at the Gilgo Beach serial killings. And for anyone who hasn't heard of those, because I had not, there is a Hulu special about the Gilgo Beach serial killings. And the person that they believe committed these crimes was arrested actually not too long back. It was in July of 2023, right? So about 6 months ago. And so these killings were a string of killings from 1996 to 2011, where they found 11 people murdered along in the beach area of Gilgo Beach in Long Island, New York. So this was, it's really sad. I mean, obviously murders are always sad, but this is really sad in the fact that, like, most of these women were sex workers who, like, were advertising on Craigslist. And they were looking for a specific person who disappeared, Shannon Gilbert, in 2011, or before 2010. And, like, they found these four victims that they call the Gilgo Four. They found these four bodies. None of them were Shannon Gilbert. She was the fifth one found. So this is why it's sad to me. You've got all these sex workers. They're looking for this one particular one. But nobody is looking for these other four. And after they found Shannon Gilbert, they found six others. 11 were found. But the only one they were looking for was Shannon. So it's kind of like why they think, like, Jack the Ripper killed prostitutes, right? Because nobody looks for them. I don't know if it's that, though. Because I think it could be that. I think serial killers generally have a high intellect. But I want to get your opinion on it. Like, part of me thinks maybe it's just convenience. It's a lot easier to take home a sex worker from Craigslist than it is to go to a bar and pick up a woman.
Well, yeah. No, convenience is absolutely part of it. And usually, you know, you look into enough serial killer stories and there's always some kind of sexual component to it that's, you know, even more gag-worthy. But, you know, I do think that there's a lot of it that goes into it is the fact that these are people that aren't going to be missed, and I think that you know you never know, like when somebody kills somebody and then gets caught for it, would they have turned into a serial killer if that person hadn't have been somebody that they were that merited more effort to search for, you know, like if it's convenience, you can call an Uber driver and then kill them, but then that's an easy paper trail back to you.
Right.
And so, I do think...
I mean, I would feel like Craigslist ads, don't they have some sort of record too, though?
I think that you can, you know, it's a little bit sketchier. Like, all you need is an email address, you know, and those are a lot easier to, like, kind of muddy up. You create one on a different IP address and whatever, you know, it's, I think it takes, at the very least, it takes more effort to investigate where that email came from. But as opposed to Uber, where your credit card is tied to it and your personal info, but no, I think it's convenience, obviously, in it, but it's, I think it's the fact that, like, you can easily get away with it.
Yeah.
You know, these are people whose families have probably given up on them, who don't have people looking for them. And if they do have people looking for them, they're not going to get much attention from the police,
right?
Because of their line of work.
I mean, I think that's fair, given the fact that this guy started these killings. As far as we know, the first victims were from 2007, so he killed. He was able to evade the police for 16 years. He's either the smartest dude alive, or he also was picking people that nobody's going to look for, right? Which also makes him smart if you don't want to get caught, right? So
I don't know. You're giving him too much credit. Like, it's... I think we have been so inundated with these police procedurals, you know, these shows that are on, that I feel like we think that detective agencies or detective departments at our police, the local police department is just filled with geniuses who are, you know, troubled and brilliant and can solve any crime. And I don't think that's the case. I think if you take a certain amount of steps, you can get away with these things for a long time. I mean, yeah, you have a lot more. You have DNA evidence. You have, yeah, you know, that, but... I think a moderate amount of intelligence and a desire not to get caught, and I don't think it's that hard.
Yeah, and we'll find in this case, as in many of the other ones that we've looked into, there's some police work that's botched here too, and there's the way that they actually catch him was evidence that they had back in like the early 2000s, and somebody, yeah, a detective looked at the cold case, right, and found this, and like nobody had really looked at it, and it was very important evidence. So we'll get into that stuff. After pondering the nature of the victims, it was time to look at them individually. Let's go over the victims just real quick. I don't like blowing through the victim, but there's 11 of them, and right, like, just for time's sake, I'll go quick. But we have Maureen Brainerd Barnes. She was 25 when she disappeared, last seen July 9th, 2007. Saying she planned to spend the day in New York. She was a mother of two, and she was a sex worker who was on Craigslist. Then we have Melissa Barthelemy. She was 24, Erie, New York, went missing July 12, 2009, been living in the Bronx, sex worker who was on Craigslist. We have Megan Waterman, 22, South Portland, Maine, went missing June 6, 2010, after placing advertisements on Craigslist as an escort. Amberlyn Costello, 27, West Babylon, New York, small town 10 miles north of Gilgo. She was a sex worker and a heroin user. Those were the Gilgo four. So those were the initial ones found. Then they found Shannon that they were looking for, who was on Craigslist. Valerie Mack, 24, also known as Melissa Taylor. She was an escort. She went missing in 2000. So, I forgot to say this part. The ones they found after the four, they said actually had happened earlier, which probably makes sense, right? Because their bodies would be more decomposed, harder to find. Jessica Taylor, 20 years old, missing July 2003. Her naked, dismembered torso and missing head and hands were discovered 45 miles east of Gilgo. Karen Vergata, she was 34, from Manhattan. Believed to be a sex worker, disappeared in 1996. So that's an old case. Then an unidentified, they just call her Peaches. Peaches, who was an Asian male, and they, with the DNA, they were never able to figure out what their actual name was. So those were all the victims. So this person had been very prolific as far as being caught, right? Like I said, there were a couple botched things. So I'll tell you, one of the major botched things was, I learned this from the documentary, not in the articles that I've been reading, but one of the victims had a friend who was with her when this 6'4" person came in a Chevy. Is it Chevy Avalanche? It's an Avalanche. That's Chevy, right? Well, anyways, it was an Avalanche. And this person started getting very weird, and she wanted him to leave, so the dude asked him to leave. He got irate, like, wouldn't leave. The dude was, like, actually about to fight him. This dude's, like, 6'4", like, the person that they ended up catching, right? So, finally, the dude goes after him, and the guy just gets in his car, and he, like, stares him down as he drives away in this Avalanche. Then, within a month, this girl goes missing, and she's one of the victims. And the guy immediately calls the police. He gives a description of the man, and he tells him about the avalanche. So that was one of the earlier crimes. And later, a police officer was looking at the cold case, like, sees this thing about the avalanche, 6'4". Avalanches weren't very popular back then, and quickly he's able to find the person that is charged with these crimes. So had they actually looked into that back then, they would have actually probably been able to keep a lot more people from dying. So that's very sad, right? Then they said one of the main investigators in the case, who also ended up, he quit his job, and because he had been charged with some crimes, he had been very active in utilizing escorts in the area, and they said he just didn't want to dig too deep into any of that. So there were some problems with the investigations, for sure. After looking at the victims, it was time to finally take a look at Rex Huerman. Let's look at the person of interest. Well, actually, we'll look at a person of interest, then we'll look at the actual person who was arrested for these crimes. So on September 12th, 2017, Suffolk County Prosecutor Robert Biancalavilla said that John Bitroff of Suffolk County, resident convicted of murdering two sex workers and suspected in the murder of a third, may have committed some of the Go-Go Beach murders.
Now, what was the detective's name again?
That detective's name was Robert Biancalavilla. B-I-A-N-C-A-V-I-L-L-A.
Have you noticed, like, a lot of these stories involve, like, a detective with a very, very Italian-sounding name?
Yeah, that's true.
I wonder why that is.
Yeah, I don't know.
I wonder why that's anyway, alright, go ahead.
Yeah, so Biltroff was arrested in 2014 after his DNA was found on the bodies of two murdered victims, Rita Tangredi and Colleen McNaney, whose bodies were found in 1993 and 94, respectively. The match had been made through DNA submitted by his brother, who was convicted in 2013 on an unrelated case. But he was just never able to be tied to these murders. However, in July of 2023, Rex Andrew Huerman, 59-year-old Nassau County resident, was arrested in Midtown Manhattan and subsequently charged with the three counts of first-degree murder, as well as three counts of lesser charge of a second-degree murder related to the deaths of Melissa Barthelemy, Megan Waterman, Amber Costello. He was also the prime suspect in the death of Maureen Brainerd Barnes, and he pleaded not guilty. Like I said, he was found because of the avalanche. So this is the person they found. So this guy actually knew Billy Baldwin, yeah. So actor William Baldwin told NBC News after his arrest that they were both classmates at Berner High School, and Baldwin replied that he had an unlikely connection to him and described him as a mind-boggling student. So he was this great student, and he ends up being an architect. But yeah, authorities began to seriously consider Huerman as a suspect in March 2022 after discovering that a Chevy Avalanche registered in his name had been linked to one of the killings by a witness. Linked to one of the killings and a witness, like I said, about 10 years prior. So, very disturbing that it took that long to look at that piece of evidence. His cell phone records indicated that he had been in contact with three of the four victims. An email account linked Huerman to online searches, etc. After an initial look at Huerman, it's time to look at some of the details of the documentary. I'm going to leave that timeline alone for a second, just kind of go into some of the things from the documentary that were really interesting. So Huerman was such a fucked up dude that he took the phones of the victims on several occasions, and he looked up their contacts, and he would call their family members and taunt them after he had killed their relatives, because he was so sadistic. Like, he not only wanted to hurt these people, he wanted to hurt their families after he hurt these people. Like, I've never heard of anything like that. That's crazy, right?
I've heard, the Golden State Killer that would do that. He would go and he would rape women, and then he would stay in the room very quietly and very silently for, like, hours, until, like, the woman would, because he would violently, like, rape them at, like, knife point or gunpoint.
Yeah.
And then they would think that he left, and then he would just jump out and scare them again.
Yeah.
And I there's some connection, like, whatever chemical release they get from murder, whatever sexual pleasure they get from that, they get to relive it when they hear the pain from other people. It's right. Their way of reliving that stuff.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's fucking weird, right? Like, and then there were several cases of people that, like, didn't end up getting killed but had weird interactions with this guy. One, a former escort had an unsettling dinner with him about 8 years before his arrest. He had initiated a conversation about the Gilgo Beach murders, which had recently been discovered, and she recalled the meeting that he was not discussing the murders as a true crime buff, but rather in a more personal way. She subsequently arranged for a friend to meet her outside in the parking lot because she realized was off. She, thank goodness, her friend came and she got in the car. She said he was hella pissed when she left, but she was able to get away. And she told everyone from that point on she was positive that she had met the Gilgo Beach murderer. And she actually was in the documentary. She said that she is willing to testify against him now. The reason she didn't contact the police then is she has a drug history, and she didn't think they would take her seriously. But at this point, she's like, she'll do whatever she needs to do, because she knew that was the same dude that she had gone out with who had been asking about these murders, right? So, yeah, this guy, total piece. You've got some of his neighbors, like they do often, talking about how, oh, he was so quiet and we didn't suspect any of this. But he has one neighbor whose dad called him immediately when he was at work and said, hey, you know that neighbor I have that we always say is a serial killer? He just got arrested for being a serial killer. Like, so some people knew, or at least had suspected. So when they actually arrest him, they get, obviously, a warrant to look through his stuff, dig up his yard. They dig in his yard to look for more victims. Since this killer had been so prolific, they thought maybe they'd find more victims in the yard. They do not. But what they find in his yard is all kinds of shit from the victims, like cell phones, right, like clothing.
Yeah.
So his mementos he had, like, buried. So this guy is looking kind of hella guilty. He's currently on trial. He actually just had his last trial date was February 7th, right? So what's that, like 2 weeks ago? What are we at? 23? So, yeah, he's still in court right now. Next, we explore the family life of Rex Huerman. Just to go into a little bit about his family life, because, like I said, I couldn't find anything bad. He had two parents. His dad died when he was 11, so he had that traumatic event. But it didn't say anything about anyone being abusive. It didn't say anything about his mom being abusive. So, yeah, he was the son of Dolores and Theodore Huerman. According to the wedding announcement, which said that the father was deceased. His father was, according to him, an aerospace engineer. I'm not sure why it says according to him. That's a little bit weird. Like, maybe they can't prove that this guy was an aerospace engineer, but it seems like he comes from an intelligent family. So the house he currently lived in, which they call, like, a ramshackle, is the house he lived in with his mom, dad, and his brother. Huerman has, like, he was married once, and then he got divorced, and then he was married to his current wife for 21 years. He has a daughter who was working in his architectural firm. She has a bachelor's of fine arts, and then he's got a son that they said was special needs, and they said he was a real nice boy, but they didn't say what the special needs were. But to me, it, like, kind of screamed, like, almost like BTK, right, where, like, this guy has this total secret life. This is, like,
yeah.
He's taking care of a special needs kid, and he's a serial killer. That's weird, right?
Yeah, I mean, whatever sickness that he had in him, he very quickly figured out a way to satiate it, to satisfy it, and you know, he was an architect, right?
He was an architect, yeah.
And so, you know, the assumption is that he had enough disposable income to be able to go on these little sprees every once in a while. Because, you know, like I said, I think if you have, you know, a little bit of resources and time, you can avoid capture if you're smart enough, and it sounds like he was.
Yeah. More evidence revisited. So yeah, I hear the cat. That's another piece of the evidence, by the way, when you're talking about his sprees, was that they found that his family was always out of town every time that these events occurred.
Yeah.
So his timeline's not real good for him. And they found one of his wife's hairs on one of the victims. Like,
oh, shit.
Probably came off of him, of course, right? Like, his wife was always out of town during these murders, but like, or these disappearances and murders, but like, her hair probably just fell off his clothes or something onto her, I would assume, right? But yeah, so this Huerman guy, by the way, like, he's an architect, but they showed him like doing commercials for his firm, and it was really fucking disturbing. Nothing bad, but like, you could tell he thought he very highly of himself. He does this thing where they talk about the company's getting like bright or something, like its future looks bright, and him and this other guy put on sunglasses and they stand there like posing. But my point of that is just that, like, he doesn't seem like socially awkward. He doesn't seem weird. Like, he seems kind of like he would actually be the guy in the room who's talking a lot because he's kind of full of himself. But I guess that leans towards like a narcissistic type of personality, right?
Right.
So I think he was more of that dominant, narcissistic type of killer. Not the we always knew something was wrong because he didn't interact with other human beings type of person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's hard to know what people are hiding, you know, if they're good enough at it. You know, some people are capable of incredible guile, and they can compartmentalize parts of their personality.
Yeah.
I never could do that. No matter who I thought I could try to be, I was just always me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel like my personality varies from situation to situation. Other than, obviously, if you're in a job interview, you put the twitching aside and you become super confident and I'm the best person for this job. But after that, you're like, I pulled that off, thank God, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's just increasing, you know, certain parts of your already existing personality, but going from like confident executive to slayer of streetwalkers is a little bit more extreme.
Yeah, for sure. It's hard to, I mean, obviously, like I said, his family was always out of town during this, but it's hard to believe people can hide this shit. Because it's like, I don't know if he's throwing away his clothes, if like what he's doing, like if they're coming home and like he's already disposed of everything, he's already cleaned up, like he's just a master of cleaning this shit up. But like, maybe him and his wife have been together so long that she really doesn't care what he's doing, but it's like, are they not texting? Are they not calling each other? Like, how is this dude able to just like go on these sprees? And like, is he using credit cards for these prostitutes? Is he paying in cash? Like, it just feels like there would be a trail. Did his wife know that he was with escorts? And maybe she just didn't care about that part because she obviously didn't realize he's murdering escorts.
Yeah, I mean, I think different marriages, you can keep secrets fairly easily.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I wonder, you know, if they just enjoyed being, you know, having their own time and valued that. She valued, you know, space and time. And just could have never imagined that he was using that time to do the things he was doing.
Right. And maybe he was like the best dad in the world, and she's just like, there's no way, right? Like, I don't know. Because you figure even though the police weren't able to figure any of these out, because they don't seem to have been looking super hard for any of these people, like, these had to have at least been a headline at some point, right? So there were all these people disappearing from the mid-90s to 2010, right, or 2011, so it just seems like somebody would be like, you know what, my neighbor seems like he could be that guy, right? Like, it's just so hard to believe these people are this good at hiding this major facet of their life.
Really hard to figure out you know, what how people get away with doing things like that. I don't know.
Yeah. Most serial killers do suffer abuse, so we speculate on Rex. But, I mean, so Dahmer was abused. We know that Ted Bundy suffered some abuse. Like, is there any way that this guy wasn't abused and is able to and is did these things? Like, is it possible that there's no nature in it? It's or no nurture in it. I mean, it's all nature. Like, is it possible that he lived a perfect life and he did these things?
Oh yeah, it's absolutely possible. I think that there's some, I think that there's some wiring that sometimes just gets plugged into a certain port, and that's just who they are. That's just what they, you know, what they do, what they like. I don't know how or why, but it just is.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I think trauma, childhood trauma definitely
aids it.
Can awaken those things in people. And it can damage people's brains, the way their brains work, enough to, like, to make them do those things. But I think there's too many kids out there who have suffered abuse and not become monsters to say that abuse does this. I think there's something inside of people, and it's just there.
Right.
And sometimes nature exacerbates it or activates it or, you know, or in some cases causes it by messing with the brain so much. But I don't think it's the only cause of whatever you want to call this, psychopathy or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right with you. Like, I think, like, that's why I always say, like, the perfect storm. I know it's, like, a really kind of overused phrase. But to me, it's like, Jeffrey Dahmer had to have had emotional, mental issues, right? He had things going on. But then you throw on the fact that he was abused from the time he was a little kid, and now you have this perfect storm. Where if he had been somebody who didn't have emotional issues and he had gone through that abuse, obviously there's a lot of people like that. Like, people kind of can go both ways, right? Like, they can either become a horrible monster, or they can be someone who's an advocate and protects other people, and, right? Like, they can go complete reverse of that. Or they can be someone that doesn't do either of those things. They just live their life and try their best to cope, right? Like,
yeah.
Just, we've got, like, a large array of responses to things based on our genetic makeup and what we go through, so, yeah. It's hard to say what makes somebody into these monsters, but I think it is normally a combination. But I do think you're right. Every once in a while, you have someone that's just born that way.
Yeah. And I think that unraveling, you know, how and why, I mean, you know, you have a master's in psychology, and you probably verify, like, you know, our understanding of how the wires in the brain work is very, very, it's in its infancy.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have data from studies, but they're very few and they're very little, and they're just kind of darts in the dark.
Right.
And every once in a while a dart will hit a board, and then we spend 20 years trying to figure out why that dart hit that board.
Right.
You know, and so there's, you know, there's some neural pathway that gets blocked or gets built that just connects people to this. This is, just the feeling of stabbing somebody, the feeling, whatever, just, that's my thing. And, you know,
I'm laughing because, you know, to me that would be like the most horrible thing, right? Like, I don't want to know what that feels like. I know what it feels like when I accidentally cut my hand a few months ago. That sucked. I don't want to... Steve considers some important thoughts about empathy.
Well, you know, and you talk about, like, a lack of empathy, because I think that, you know, you have to have a lack of empathy to be able to do that. Like, you know, it's easy for us to imagine what these injuries would feel like to us, so why the hell would we want to inflict them on other people?
Right.
That sounds terrible. And, but...
Yeah, and this guy's, he's calling and taunting, like, the victim's family. He's a complete sadist, right? Like, he's got no empathy. Yeah. He is completely the opposite of empathy. He is getting off on torturing these people.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's a release of whatever it is, what, serotonin?
Yeah.
Right? It's
dopamine,
it's
serotonin. Getting... Both.
What is it?
Dopamine and serotonin, probably both.
Yeah. And so there's a release there. And I know that there's different, like, ways that your brain can get screwed up temporarily, like where pain can feel like pleasure, like the communication gets messed up because of whatever, you know, trauma or something, physical trauma or you know, whatever. But so somehow emotional pain equals pleasure to these people.
Mm-hmm.
Like others emotional, and I don't know how that works.
Should serial killers be put in mental health facilities versus prisons?
Yeah, I mean, and like, from killers' brains that have been studied, right, they do have differences in their brains. So there's another question for you. Should they be in prison, or should somebody that does this automatically be put in a mental health, like, long-term, meaning forever type of lock-up Michael Myers type of facility?
I mean, you know, I think we are in some desperate need of prison reform overall, and I wouldn't mind using people that do things like this, you know, studying them.
Yeah.
Getting more information, but I don't know how that could, you know, possibly be helpful.
Right.
Because you really only know it after the person's done it.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like studying CTE in football players.
Yeah, the concussion, right? You know, stuff, yeah.
They can only truly diagnose it after the player's dead, and they can look at the brain.
Yeah.
And they can say, oh yeah, this is somebody who has CTE. But...
Alzheimer's can only be diagnosed after someone's dead. Like, they will make the diagnoses just because of all the signs, but to actually know someone has Alzheimer's and that's progressed from dementia, they have to be dead to look at their brain, but...
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Prisons compared to dog pounds.
But talking about prison reform, though, the article you sent me, the person that didn't commit the crime compared the prison he was in to a dog pound, and, like... From the neighborhood I grew up in, you know, very poor neighborhood, like, there was a dog pound in that area, and, like, we used to go there to look at the dogs because that was a fun thing to do when you're a kid, and it was, the conditions were horrific, and, like, for some reason I just feel like the person in the article that you sent was, like, looking at the same kind of dog pounds I was, and it's like, God, that probably is what prison's like, and that's atrocious. It's atrocious for an animal, let alone a human being.
We have just become satisfied with just housing them, just keeping them
breathing
from getting out,
yeah.
and that's it.
Locked up and breathing, right? We don't want them dead, and we don't want them out.
Yeah, and nothing beneficial comes from it whatsoever, you know, other than, like, you know, some of the people that would be repeat offenders. You know, keeping them off the street, but the majority of people in there are, you know, well, I shouldn't even say majority. I don't have the numbers, but, like, you know, there's a lot of people in prison that would benefit from programs geared to help them. Not that the Gilgo Beach guy, that fuck him, you know,
yeah,
like, but, you know, so many people in prison would benefit from that, like.
Steve relays a story of positive programs in prisons.
My grandfather was a guard at a penitentiary on the Panama Canal Zone in the 1930s and 40s. and he ran a, like, basically a work program there, and he would teach them, you know, you had to qualify, prisoners had to qualify for it, but sometimes they'd take them out and do some bushwhacking, you know, with a machete, which is mind-boggling to me that you would hand these prisoners machetes, but,
right.
You know, clearing paths, but then also, like, automotive repair and woodworking. Like, I actually have some furniture here that was built in the prison.
Wow.
By prisoners. At least in a couple cases, there were guys that got out and got jobs.
Nice.
And would write to my grandfather and say, you know, you're the reason that I can make a life now.
And that's awesome. That's awesome.
All victims should be treated the same, no matter what their life status is.
I mean, like, yeah, prison reform, huge, and then the other really sad aspect of this that needs looked at, and I don't know what the answer is, but somehow everyone has to realize that just because somebody's down on their luck and doing sex work doesn't mean that they're not a human being, right? Like, if these women had actually been cared about, these crimes probably would have been solved forever ago.
Well, and lots of real cops, you know, do care and do put in work. You know, it's just, there's a matter of resources, and you get the thing, you know, when you have a victim who has a lot of family
with deep pockets, yeah.
Well, just the support of, like, keeping the case fresh and constantly, like, calling for updates, and they're going to get more results because...
And they can fundraise.
Yeah, but, like, and just the idea that, like, the police are like, well, shit, they're going to call me tomorrow, you know?
Mm.
Like, they're going to keep calling. I need to have answers. And so you're going to get, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
True. Very true.
And so, but if nobody's advocating for, you know, for Jane Doe, or if nobody's advocating for this missing sex worker, or a few people are, or if you look into it and their background is so messy that it's like, well, yeah, that might be something nefarious, but she's also disappeared on 8-month meth benders, right. And so am I really going to put that much effort into finding her, you know, in some, you know, cracked out basement?
Tying up a few loose ends.
Speaking of that, like, I forgot to tell you that the Shannon girl that they were actually looking for that made them find the other girls, they said that she might have drowned. But then the coroner said she might have been strangled. And it's like, they found 11 people in this area. Why would you assume this woman drowned?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and drowning and getting strangled, you know, it's
both choking.
It's similar enough.
Yeah.
You know.
Both losing breath.
Benefit of the doubt, it's just a medical examiner who wants to be as accurate as possible.
Yeah. I would just think for strangulation, you'd have to have some sort of marking on the neck, some sort of pushing in of, like, the trachea or whatever, and, like, I don't know how you would just say, maybe it was that, if you don't have that information.
Right. Well, you know, but if they were in water,
yeah,
they were found.
Yeah, they were. Well, I mean, she was. That's by why they thought she drowned.
Well, so like the skin around the neck is going to be bloated and damaged.
That's
from being
fair.
In the water.
That's fair.
And there's also the potential for the body to be like
fish and
you
stuff.
Know, to suffer some post-mortem trauma.
Yeah.
You know. Who knows?
Yeah, that's fair. Alright, so, yeah, depressing, horrible serial killer on trial now. So, yeah, if you guys are interested in this case, Rex Huerman, he's on trial now. You can look up information on him. And like I said, there is a Hulu documentary out right now called The Gilgo Beach something or other. So, yeah, look up Gilgo Beach. You'll find it. And thank you for joining us on Malice Intended. You can find us, as always, on Malice Intended bks@gmail.com if you want to get in touch with us and let us know of any episodes you want to hear. And I am Ben, and thank you for joining me. And Steve?
I'm Steve, and thank you for joining me, too.
Nice. All right. We did it.
Bye.